from the Sky News Centre at 6. The White House says America and Britain have agreed to work together to beat cybercrime. David Cameron's in Washington, where he's been meeting President Obama. They've confirmed plans to conduct cybersecurity war games and set up a joint cyber cell, which will share intelligence about hackers. The Prime Minister says it's in both countries' interests.
We've stood together so often, not just because we've faced common threats, but because we fundamentally believe in the same things. That is as true today as it has always been.
Meanwhile, a teenager from Merseyside's being questioned over the hacking of Sony's PlayStation and Microsoft Xbox networks on Christmas Day. The 18-year-old's also accused of making death threats in a so-called swatting attack. Police patrols are being stepped up in Jewish areas, and there's going to be a review of protection offered to police officers themselves. Britain's most senior anti-terror officer has announced the measures following the attacks in Paris last week. Mark Rowley says there are a number of reasons why they're reviewing things.
This isn't about one particular operation or one particular threat at the moment. It's more about these organisations' long-term declared intent and determination. And as we feel that escalates, we have to escalate our response to match it.
The Attorney General's asked prosecutors to investigate if a website set up in support of convicted rapist Ched Evans unlawfully identified his victim. It follows a complaint from her father last month. After weeks of longer waits, more patients were seen within the four-hour target at England's A&E departments last week. But separate figures have revealed a worsening picture in Wales and Northern Ireland last month. And a British space probe has been found on the surface of Mars more than 11 years after scientists lost contact with it. It had been assumed that Beagle 2 had been destroyed. Well, that's the latest. I'm Jo Davies.
As you look into my eyes and listen to my voice, your will is leaving you, slipping away. And you are now beneath my influence. Although your eyes are open and you seem aware, you are in fact asleep. Your faculties dormant. Your ability to act and think subservient to my will. My will.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Imagine opening your long-dead grandfather's old attaché case to find documents proving he was one of Britain's greatest war heroes, but he'd been written out of history. Yet another exclusive this week in our investigation of dirty deals done by the US and British governments at the end of World War II with the Nazis they were still supposed to be fighting. Did James Bond author Ian Fleming, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, his mysterious assistant Desmond Morton, Lord Louis Mountbatten, even King George VI all do deals with the Nazis' looted billions? This week, Jill Goulding never knew what her grandfather Harold did in World War II until she opened an attaché case in the loft and found scores of secret documents which prove Harold was one of the great heroes of World War II. So why, despite his being commanding officer of the Special Boat Service, awarded the DSO Medal, do veterans groups refuse to recognise him? And why did he die just months after the end of the war? Dieppe, 3,500 Canadian casualties from Wednesday the 19th of August 1942. But did some of the top British military commanders deliberately send 3,500 Canadians to their deaths in Dieppe so the Germans would believe their spy was loyal to the Nazis? Staying with Canada, the 9/11 Consensus Panel is planning to force a debate in the Canadian Parliament about what really happened in New York and Washington on 9/11. But first, Shredded. It's the FT's recommended book of last year, and it's all about Fred the Shred and his bank we are now supposed to own, which is still refusing to lend to many and taking perfectly good businesses apart to asset strip them. So I'm joined on the line now by financial journalist and author Ian Fraser, who's author of Shredded. Hi, Ian, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, Ian, can you tell us a little bit about the book? When did it come out? And why did you decide to write it?
Okay. The line sounds slightly fuzzy this time. Is it okay for you?
Absolutely fine.
Okay. Well, I wrote the book was published in June last year, on the 5th of June, and it was published by a publishing company called Berlin. And the reason I chose to write it was because the collapse of RBS in October 2008 was like a cataclysmic event for the UK economy. It's definitely pushed up the UK government debt to a huge extent because of the cost of the bailout. RBS was a bank that had really got pretty much out of control under the leadership of Fred the Shred Goodwin. And I just thought people might be interested in finding out, you know, what actually went on inside the bank and, you know, how that caused it to become the most expensive bank in the world to bail out and how it managed to become the largest bank in the world by assets in December 2007, larger than either Citigroup or HSBC or any of the Chinese or Japanese banks. And particularly how the UK government, in fact, was really asleep at the wheel and how the regulators were asleep at the wheel and allowed this cataclysmic event to happen.
Well, I mean, you're saying the bank's out of control. Actually, in a way, anyone that's not being regulated is going to start doing what they want. Is that what happened?
To an extent, yes. I mean, there was a kind of delusional thinking amongst regulators and central bankers and politicians in the build-up to the 2008 crisis, which was that you know, the market always knew best, and that regulation should be minimized or reduced, and that bankers and senior bankers in particular could be trusted to manage their institutions responsibly without much regulation, because they would have the interests of their shareholders at heart, and therefore ensure that the banks didn't take too many outrageous risks. But it turned out to be a flawed ideology. It's what I call the Greenspan doctrine. It was really promulgated by a man called Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve from 86 till 2006, and it was adhered to by many governments and regulators and central banks around the world.
There's something bizarre about all this, Ian, because almost everything that we do in our lives is regulated in some way, whether it's, you know, keeping to the speed limit. And it seems as if the closer you get to the most power, and of course banks have a tremendous amount of power. A licensed bank can do an amazing amount of stuff. It can create money out of nowhere, lend it out at interest, all this kind of thing. And it can make the difference between life and death. Obviously, you need money to buy food, to put a roof over your head, to buy water, to drink, to stay alive. And yet it seems that something so important, there was such a light touch regulation. There was just a far too close relationship, and probably still is, between high government officials and the bankers who have the say-so over, often, whether we live or die.
Yes, I think you make some very good points there. I mean, I think, you know, there was a kind of symbiotic relationship, obviously, between any government, particularly, I'm talking about the new Labour government of 97 to 2010, and the banking industry. They were getting $70 billion a year in tax from the City of London, and as sort of quid pro quo, they were sort of promising not to regulate them too much. And in particular, there was a moment in 2003 when the US government actually did strengthen its regulation through something called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which, believe it or not, was pushed through by the government of George W. Bush. And at that moment, it seems to me that, well, from the evidence that I've seen, that both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown as Chancellor thought this was a great opportunity for the UK, because they would go the other way and they'd actually embark on what's been called a regulatory race to the bottom in order to enable them, their mates in the City of London. And Fred Goodwin had ingratiated himself with the new Labour leaders ahead of that by basically you know, lowering the regulatory bar. So, you know, if one were to blame people for the banking crisis of 2008, I think the government of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown would have to bear a significant portion of the blame.
Now, we were listening to Owen Jones in the first hour, his talk on BBC Three before Christmas on the telly on a discussion programme, really saying that why don't we have Banker Street? Why don't we have Tax Dodger Street? Because these people do seem to be sort of almost in another world, like kind of otherworldly. They're somewhere else. They're not kind of the kind of people that mingle with us, the 0.001%, that kind of thing. So yeah. What were you able to show in Shredded what was going on behind closed doors inside RBS?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of partying, obviously. There was a kind of regime of fear as well, led by Fred Goodwin, because he was a fairly brutal chief executive who could be very charming to people, you know, when they were out in the pub drinking till 2 in the morning of an evening. But the next morning, you know, at 9 o'clock at something called the morning meeting or morning beating, as they became known, he would metaphorically knife that person in the back, you know, telling them they'd screwed up on a deal or they'd failed to produce the correct paperwork for a new loan or whatever it was. And so there was an odd culture, you know, in some ways of quite, it was very male orientated, I think, probably quite misogynist, probably. You know, there weren't that many senior female bankers in there, and it was also quite brutal, you know, because Fred just seemed to drive people very hard, and in fact that wasn't one of the reasons why the bank failed, because at the end of each year, I think in any large company they set targets for each division in terms of what its profit should be by the end of the following December. And, you know, any cost cuts that could be made over the course of the next 12 months and those sorts of things.
So how much has actually changed, Ian? I mean, we've had the whole thing has been brought into the public sector, believe it or not, even though it doesn't really seem to be behaving as if it has. And what we're talking about here is, you know, this happened in the past. Has anything really much changed?
Well, I think there was a huge missed opportunity in October 2008, because both Barack Obama and Gordon Brown had the opportunity to make to push for radical reform of the financial sector in exchange for rescuing it with bailouts, but they didn't do that. They basically did a kind of band-aid on a gaping wound and let it carry on pretty much as before.
Well, hang on a minute, because Gordon Brown said he saved the world.
Yeah, he said that at the time. He actually said that in the House of Commons, I think, and I think Paul Krugman, the U.S., the columnist in the New York Times, who's also a Nobel Prize-winning economist, said Gordon Brown had helped to save the world. But he hadn't really, you know, he just basically enabled the banking sector to go back to the status quo ante, you know, what it was doing before, the same sort of thing it was doing before, with a kind of band-aid solution. And you know, I think it's very, very sad that, you know, if there was ever a moment when politicians could have pushed for significant reform of the global financial system and of the banking sector in particular, it was September, October 2008, but the opportunity was missed.
So how much power does RBS have politically? Because this is what interests me. I mean, we know that people who are quite close to the financial services industry actually fund some of our major political parties. And what way are banks like RBS able to actually flex their muscles politically?
Well, it's quite bizarre because, you know, that particular bank is still 80% owned by the UK government, i.e. the taxpayer. And so you'd have thought that the government would have a lot of power over it. But the reality is it almost seems to be the other way around. It's almost like the government is so determined to try to resell the shares that it owns in the bank at a profit that it won't do anything which would impede its ability to supposedly, you know, to manage itself in ways that...
Hang on, while you sort that out, Ian, I'm going to ask Martin about that. Martin.
Ian, it strikes me that RBS, the size of RBS, I believe it's several times bigger than the whole US, UK economy. Am I correct in presuming that?
It certainly was at the time it's bailed out, and I think it still is marginally. It has been reduced in size. I mean, that's one thing that has happened since the bailout.
But, I mean, it strikes... I mean, surely there is an imbalance of power inevitable. If RBS's assets globally are bigger than the UK economy, it becomes rather absurd to see the UK economy as a backstop to rescue all of what are essentially international institutions with paper assets which are bigger than the actual national economy.
Well, it does, and it should... I mean, in my view, it should never have been allowed to grow to the scale it did. The government should never have allowed it to acquire NatWest in 2000, and definitely should not have allowed it to acquire ABN AMRO in 2007. You know, those are deals which the government had the ability to block, and the FSA had the ability to block, but it just waved them through. So you're right, it should never have been allowed to grow to the scale that it did. But then there are, you know, two or three other banks which are of similar size, including HSBC, Lloyds Banking Group, and Barclays. So, you know, we've, to an extent, in allowing our banks to grow to the scale that they've been allowed to grow to, through just very puny regulation and virtually zero competition or antitrust policies, we've enabled them to wear the trousers, you know, in terms of who actually is controlling the government.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it almost seems like we've got a kind of new feudal hierarchy with the king and the dukes actually being sitting in the City of London running banks and ordering political parties around, ordering the press around, buying up people that are sort of criticising them.
Yeah, well, actually, the appointment of the woman who used to be on the board of HSBC as chairman of the is it the trustees of the BBC or
yeah, that's Rona Fairhead, and she was on the risk committee of HSBC when she must have been, I suppose, having papers going across her desk saying, well, there's all this money laundering going on in Mexico, do we want to take the risk? And that and she's now running the BBC. She's chairman of the trust.
That's right. And to me, that's symbolic of the kind of, well, that's one example of what I call the revolving door between government and the banking sector, and between regulators and the banking sector. So, I mean, I don't know whether it's fair to say that the banks essentially are controlling the government and or controlling Whitehall, but they certainly have a pretty high degree of influence over it, and I think that's been self-evident in the way in which the coalition government of David Cameron and Nick Clegg has handled RBS and Lloyds since the crisis of 2008. I mean, for example, they're desperately keen to sell shares in Lloyds Banking Group to city investors before the election of May this year. But in order to achieve that, it would appear that they are deliberately delaying trials, which will make the public aware of widespread fraud within Lloyds that occurred inside Lloyds, or sorry, HBOS, which was the bank it merged with. I think in order to offload shares to institutional shareholders prior to the election, it would appear, certainly to me, that the government is suppressing a number of facts. In other words, they are almost conning these institutional investors by suppressing certain bits and pieces of information.
Well, just give us an idea. What kind of information do you think that they're holding back? They're hoping that this is going to, these things are going to. It's a little bit, sounds to me a little bit like the child sexual abuse. What is turning into a possibly murder two scandal, where the idea is to keep this back until after the general election.
That could be a related topic. Yeah. But I mean, it's basically information which would make Lloyds seem less attractive to shareholders, and it relates to wrongdoing that occurred on when it was called HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland, which was a bank that merged with Lloyds in September 2008, a you know, as part of the bailout rescue package that Gordon Brown orchestrated.
Just give us an idea, Ian, of the difficulties for a financial journalist like yourself for winkling this information out, because obviously there's a big vested interest in it not coming out if it's going to affect things like share prices.
Well, it doesn't help when the judge imposes reporting restrictions on the on one of the trials. You know, that's one obvious blockage. Yeah, no, it's a serious. It's hard to get the information out, and really to get the full information out, you have to write it on things like Naked Capitalism, which is a US-based website, which is, you know, generally has a more open policy towards coverage of these sorts of matters.
Better than the Financial Times, anyway, even though they did give your book a good review. Anyway, look, we've had money laundering, haven't we, from HSBC. Horrific
yeah.
stuff going on in Mexico with HSBC's banks over there, being counters being converted to allow suitcases full of cash from these murderers to come in and be deposited. Running those suitcases around in their armoured vans at HSBC. We've had the payment protection insurance. We've had the fraudulent selling of interest rate swaps. We've had the LIBOR scandal. Millions and millions being made by the banks at the expense of everybody with a mortgage and everybody who's got loans. We've had the more recently the asset stripping scandal for the GRG at
yeah.
RBS, which Lawrence Tomlinson reported on for the government, and then found that there was an attempt to actually foreclose on his mortgage and close his business and personal bank accounts just
yeah.
for doing some investigation. And yes, but the latest one is this Forex, the foreign exchange fraud. I mean, it just seems to me that we've got one after another, after another, after another.
Yeah.
So what's going on with the latest with the foreign exchange fraud, Ian, and
okay.
And do you think there's more to come? And one of the main things about all this, of course, I don't want to ask you too many questions at once, but just finish up with this point, and that is that this is all fraud, isn't it? We're talking about mis-selling, but it's all fraud.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if a bank pulls the wool over the eyes of a customer and deliberately deceives the customer, for financial gain or pecuniary gain, as it's called, then I think, according to most, you know, dictionary or legal definitions, that is fraud. But the sector's come up with this phrase, mis-selling, which is, you know, it's been widely used since the 80s when we had the so-called pensions mis-selling scandal. But it's a convenient euphemism for banks to hide behind and for regulators to hide behind, because it seems, much less serious than committing fraud. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. But in terms of the foreign exchange market rigging, initially it looked like this was sort of just down to a few bad apples, you know, a select band of traders in six banks, including RBS, who were named the cartel, who called themselves the cartel, the bandits, or the A-team, and had various other names as well, who basically would exchange information about large trades that were happening, that their banks were about to do. To be honest with you, I don't 100% understand the mechanics of it, but the long and the short of it is they were organizing their trades so that they could skew the rate up or down to suit their own interest in terms of bets or, you know, gambles that they or their institutions were making on the price for the next day or for the next week, on the exchange rate between, say, the US dollar and the Swiss franc, or the euro and the Swiss franc, or the pound and the euro. And this, I think, was enabling their banks to profit at the expense of customers who were using them to exchange millions or billions of pounds worth of currency, who could have been in pension funds or investment trusts or unit trusts or endowment funds or charities. So essentially, it's a way in which the banks were manipulating foreign exchange rates for their own benefit, and the losers were were their customers, including the sorts of things I've just mentioned.
Now, I mean, that's fraud by any other name. I would say fraud. Keep saying fraud.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, ultimately, Ian, you've obviously been looking at this for quite a while. What do you think is the most likely thing that can actually positively be done about this, other than, or maybe this is one of your things that you would suggest? But, I mean, I get so frustrated that the people who've been literally making the money, that is the senior management of banks and the boards of these banks, are still walking the streets. They've not gone to jail.
Yeah, well, I think they always kind of profess ignorance and say, oh, we didn't know or whatever. But, I mean, these sorts of excuses are wearing increasingly thin. I mean, you know, if you're going to be paid, what, $7 million a year or whatever it is that the top exec at a bank earns, you damn well ought to know what's going on inside your institution. And you shouldn't just sit in your ivory tower pretending you've got no clue of how the bank is making its money. So, I mean, you know, we've had so many revelations over the past 6 years, particularly since the banking crisis, of major, I would call them frauds too, like foreign exchange rigging, like LIBOR rigging, like all the other ones you've mentioned. But each time, the authorities seem completely impotent. All they do is they'll do a no-fault settlement, or sometimes a deferred prosecution agreement with the offending institution, whereby it pays, say, between 400, it varies, obviously, up, you know, roughly 200 to 400 million, depending on what's happened. Or in the case of HSBC, it was $1.9 billion for the money laundering series of crimes. But the top guys just don't you know, these deals don't change anything, because it's not the individual bankers who are suffering. They're not being made held accountable for what's happened.
And often the trouble is, of course, the profits are actually more than the fines. So in a way, it's a kind of encouragement. Carry on doing more of the same. So anyway, look, the question I want to ask you, Ian, is: do you think there's any prospect of some of these people responsible for this, at the tops of these banks, going to jail, or banks losing their licenses, for example?
Well, it's difficult to be that optimistic. I mean, it ought to happen, because if it doesn't happen, then behaviour is not going to change radically, and banks will continue behaving very badly. But when you hear someone like Andrew Bailey, who runs the Prudential Regulation Authority of the Bank of England, which is the ultimate authority for a lot of these things in the UK, saying that HSBC is too big to prosecute, and that the US government were right not to have prosecuted it or its senior executives after the money laundering debacle, then it makes you think, well, you know, if that's what Andrew Bailey, who's, you know, appointed by George Osborne to run the PRA, thinks, then there's not much hope of any change right now. Whether or not, if Labour wins in May, it would actually change, you know, is a moot point. I don't personally think it would change radically. But in the end of the day, the banking sector will continue to behave badly, continue to fleece its customers, continue to think it can get away with what could be deemed an epidemic of fraud. For, you know, in perpetuity, and unless the top guys are held accountable. At the moment, you know, they do occasionally prosecute the what I call the low-hanging fruit, which is the individual trader who actually orchestrated a fraudulent trade, or who actually rigged the rate or whatever. But these guys are not operating in isolation. They are not just rogue individuals within an institution. They are part of a rogue culture. And I think that's what needs to be addressed.
Okay.
We've had minor attempts, like the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards, led by Andrew Tarry, which did suggest some changes, which, for example, who's the chief executive of a bank and runs it recklessly, can be jailed. But it's just not enough.
Okay, well, certainly at least we're making the point about it not being good enough, and hopefully things will change and some of these people will go to jail, as of course has happened in Iceland, and their economy is now doing very nicely, thank you very much, out of it all. So Ian Fraser, author of Shredded, FT's number one book for last year, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Okay, good speaking to you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, what about the discussion we were having there at the end, particularly about doing something about this?
Well, I think what I take home from that whole discussion is that the banks, all of them, are too big to fail and too big to jail. The political class on both sides of the Atlantic is unwilling to take them on, because if they were willing to take them on, it's quite likely that these banks would never be privatised. Nobody would want to buy them. They're insolvent junk. So they're not going to do that because they fear for the consequences for the real economy. Now, what may happen, of course, is their reckless behaviour will crash the global economy for the second time. And we discussed this in the first hour. Now, once that happens, I think the popular tolerance for this essentially criminal activity will evaporate. And at that point, the floodgates may open and large numbers of people may be prosecuted. Certainly, Peter Galbraith in the US, who is the son of the US economist J.K. Galbraith, is pretty clear that there's no solution until large numbers of people in Wall Street have been put in prison. But that won't happen until we have a further crash, I'm afraid.
Ultimately, what are the prospects for the general election making any difference, as Ian was suggesting? He wasn't convinced.
No, well, I think unless there's a crash, the Labour Party will not have the oomph or the will to tackle
any this, prospect this. Of it becoming an election issue?
No, because nobody wants to rock the boat in terms of talking the banks into insolvency. But as I've often said on this show, the banks are insolvent. That's just a fact. And at a certain point, they are going to crash, I think sooner rather than later. And then whoever the government of Britain is, and governments of around the world, will have to do something at that point, because they won't have any other option. It's pitiful, really, that they should have done stuff in 2008. But there have been a whole generation of genuflection at the altars of finance capital, and nobody was prepared to do the necessary hatchet job. After another crash, it really will be a hatchet job. We're going to be dealing with mass unrest, civil war in many countries, possibly millions of dead, and at that point, protecting the banks will not be such a high priority.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, what about the fallout from last week's Paris terrorist attacks, Martin? Because I noticed the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, has said that he actually believes it was done by the US or by the Israelis.
Yes, and of course the Daily Mail were reporting this in notes of incredulity. How can the President of Turkey say this? He's an Islamist, isn't he? Blah, blah, blah. Now, the fact is people are just profoundly ignorant in the Western world about how the world really works. In Turkey, throughout the 1980s and 1990s, lots of terrorist attacks were carried out. They were carried out by NATO intelligence services of the Ergonekon network in order to undermine the Peace and Justice Party, the Islamist party, which now rules in Turkey with an overwhelming mandate, although they do have serious opposition. So people in Turkey are well aware that a lot of terrorism is in actual fact run by intelligence services, and specifically by NATO's intelligence services. But you will find that for Middle England, that's a very hard thing for them to accept. Turkey is an integral part of NATO. Its intelligence officers and army officers are trained by our people in MI6 and in the military.
Okay. Let's just look at exactly what Erdogan has been saying. The Turkish president has accused the West of being behind the Charlie Hebdo attacks, deliberately blaming Muslims as a conspiracy theory sweep the internet, accusing Israel of orchestrating it too. The president of Turkey suggested French security forces are to blame for the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris, since the culprits had recently served prison sentences. He accused the West of playing games with the Islamic world, warning fellow Muslims to be aware. Erdogan said Muslims are paying the price for the attacks on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo.
Hebdo in a Jewish kosher supermarket in Paris last week. French citizens carry out such a massacre and Muslims pay the price, Erdogan said yesterday.
Well, yes, I mean, I think Erdogan is hinting at what other people are saying more openly, that this was a false flag attack carried out either by NATO intelligence services or by Israeli
intelligence services. Either that, or he's just making it up and electioneering.
Well, it may be so. I mean, and no doubt the Daily Mail are reporting this, but in a sort of mood of incredulity, how dare he say that? But then the Daily Mail hasn't really reported on Turkish politics over the last 30 or 40 years. Everybody who's serious in Turkey knows about the Ergonikon networks, which were rooted in the NATO intelligence services. That means MI6, CIA, MEAT, which is the Turkish equivalent. And MEAT and MI6 and the CIA have been arming, training and infiltrating jihadi terrorists into Syria over the last 3 years. It's not something that happened 30 years ago. It's what was happening 3 months ago. I'm quite sure that there are people in the British military who know exactly what's going on in Turkey, because they're based in southern Turkey, where militants are being armed and trained and infiltrated into Syria to blow things up and kill people. And of course, I don't know how many people died in Syria today, but I'll bet you it's a lot more than the 12 that died in Paris last week. But of course, there are the dead, and then there are the dead. But of course, the real world is getting nastier every day.
Paris attacks are designed to shore up France's vassal status, says Paul Craig Roberts, a former White House official, said the terrorist attack that killed 12 people last Wednesday in Paris was a false flag operation designed to shore up France's vassal status to Washington. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal. The suspects can be both guilty and patsies. Just remember all the terrorist plots created by the FBI that serve to make the terrorism threat real to Americans, he wrote.
Well, indeed, that's right. This is what people have got to get their heads round. The people who carried out the attack may believe themselves to be Islamist militants, but they are actually working within networks which are being orchestrated by intelligence agencies. That's one possible theory. I mean, we've got lots and lots of information coming out. One of the things that people ought to pick up on, which is fairly strange, is why was an Israeli journalist in exactly the right place with a video camera to video the attack? That was a bit of a coincidence, wasn't it? And that's the sort of coincidence that Erdogan, the president of Turkey, might point to. Also, of course, Netanyahu turned up to the protest demonstration about the attacks, even though he'd been specifically asked by the French not to do so, and then he pushed his way to the front and immediately started stealing the limelight. And in Turkey, you may say that they're crazy to think this, but of course it's also that the Russians have been saying very similar things. And of course there is now a rapprochement going on between Turkey and Russia. The Turks are realising that by allowing themselves to be used as a base for Islamist militants being infiltrated into Syria, they've created a rod for their own backs. And it may be that they're going to backtrack on that now and start making up with the Russians. And the Russians have put forward a plan to send an oil pipeline to Turkey, which was originally going to go to the European Union. And of course, the other thing that's happened in the last 24 hours is that the Russians have turned off the pipeline through Ukraine, plunging most of southeastern Europe into crisis because they haven't got any gas as the winter bites.
Okay, are you sure about that? I think that was a report on Zero Hedge. I'm not sure if that's true, but anyway, Martin, what's the ultimately, what does this mean for us all?
Well, I think with all of these events, we shouldn't jump to any kind of rapid conclusions about what we think happened. The very minimum I would say that's happening here is that the French, the British and others have been quite keen to overthrow Assad in Syria, and therefore have been helping, arming and training with their taxpayers' money. British taxes are going on this. They're not just being spent on benefit scroungers and on banks. We are also training jihadi terrorists to overthrow the government of Syria.
Can I just correct you on your point about the gas supply? Deutsche Welle and Bloomberg are reporting that Gazprom is warning Europe gas supplies via Ukraine are at risk. That's what they're saying.
Okay, well, the geopolitics of this are quite clear. Turkey has been in the NATO camp, and the NATO armed forces in Turkey have carried out lots of terrorist attacks inside Turkey, and that's well known to everybody in Turkey. And it may be that Turkey is going to switch sides from being part of NATO's team to being part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's team. That will be significant if it takes place.
Also interesting that there was a jihadi training camp last year discovered in in the Ardennes Forest, literally just a stone's throw away from NATO headquarters in Belgium.
Well, indeed. And it's quite possible that these... it's not even clear that the people they say carried out the attack. I mean, the attack, filmed by an Israeli journalist who just happened to be there, bit of a coincidence, was carried out by people who dressed in balaclavas to hide their identity, but then managed to leave their identity documents in the car, the getaway car, bit like the passports that were found after the so-called 9/11, after the 9/11 attacks, where they found, you know, which had melted steel and vaporized two buildings, but passports identifying the culprits were found in the rubble. Basically, a lot of these attacks are, I mean, all of these things tend to suggest that this is actually a put-up job by the intelligence services.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
And now to our exclusive tonight, an investigation of dirty deals done by the US and British governments at the end of World War II with the Nazis. They were still supposed to be fighting. Did James Bond author Ian Fleming, Prime Minister Winston Churchill and his mysterious assistant Desmond Morton, who lived just down the road from him, Lord Louis Mountbatten, even King George VI, all do deals for the Nazis, looted billions? Well, this week, Jill Goulding never knew what her grandfather Harold did in World War II until she opened an attaché case in her loft and found scores of secret documents which prove Harold was one of the greatest heroes of World War II. So why, despite his being a commanding officer of the Special Boat Service and awarded a DSO medal, do veterans groups refuse to recognise him? And why did he die just months after the end of the war? He was involved at the very top secret levels of the Special Boat Service and commando raids into Nazi-occupied Europe. And yet, his life was being kept secret. So anyway, I spoke to Jill earlier this week, and here's that interview now.
My name is Jill Goulding, and I live on Hayling Island. Back in 2010... I found my grandfather's briefcase in my mother's loft. I found out that he was working in very secret missions, and I started to do research.
Okay, so was this something that your grandmother hadn't known about, or your parents? Because this has skipped a generation, didn't it?
That's right, it skipped a generation. My father didn't know anything about his father's role in World War II, other than he had received a DSO in March 1941. He did try to find out what his father had done through the war, but always came up with blanks, other than one letter from Major General Laycock in 1946, stating that he'd done more missions on enemy coasts than any other officer of any service.
Well, if he's got a DSO, surely he's going to be quite famous, isn't he?
Well, you would have thought so, but no. When I started to do the research, I did actually find some pictures of him on the internet under the Commando Veterans website of him training SBS and SSRF. SBS is the Special Boat Service, and SSRF is the small-scale raiding force.
Okay, so they're kind of commandos, aren't they? They were going in, doing raids, actually some of them, down rivers in occupied Europe into Nazi territory. What sort of stuff have you found out that he was up to?
In 1942, at least 42, he was landing agents and very important people into occupied Europe and bringing people out, of course, some very important people as well. In 1943, we know he became the commander of SBU, which is the Special Boat Unit. Under the Special Boat Unit, there was the Royal Marines Boom Patrol Department, the Royal Naval Boom Department, the Sea Reconnaissance Unit, Sonic Warfare, 30 Assault Unit, the Royal Marines Boom Patrol, that was the Cockle Shell Heroes, known as Operation Frankton.
So what do you put the lack of your father knowing anything about this? What was it all down to? Because I know that Harold, your grandfather, died actually very quickly after the war, didn't he?
He did. He died a few weeks after the war in 1945. We really don't know. My father thought he worked within the Special Boat Service and COP, from what he can recall that his father had said. But other than that, he couldn't find out any information. Every time he approached anyone, it was just, no, sorry, we can't tell you.
Well, tell us a bit about COP, because that was an interesting unit that was training during the war, actually very close to where you live now.
Yes, that's right, and close to where my grandfather lived as well. COP is Combined Operations Pilotage Parties. They were trained on Hayling Island, initially at HMS Northney 1. Hayling Island is between Portsmouth and Chichester. It's a little island, 5 miles by four. Hayling Island Sailing Club became COP's main training centre, and they incidentally put a memorial up to COP last year. Unfortunately, my grandfather still hasn't been recognised as being their overall commanding officer in charge of their training and deployment. With the COP organisers, at first, when they started raising money for the COP memorial, they approached me and asked me to put a collage together about my grandfather's work, which I did, and that was displayed in the Hayling Island Theatre, which was to raise money, and obviously as a family we donated and supported them. After the event, I approached the organisers and asked them if they would be good enough to take this opportunity to highlight my grandfather's role within COP, and I showed them all the necessary documents of proof, but they decided to ignore the fact, gloss over it, and he still has not been recognised.
So what do you put that down to? That's a very strange reaction. You'd have thought that any organisation like that, particularly someone who's had military honours, that they would actually be quite helpful. I mean, you'd hope that anyway.
You would have hoped that, and I was very surprised, considering that the main organiser has since written a book called An Island at War about Hayling Island. He is a historian. The book is all about Hayling in the Second World War, with many photographs, all about COP, the men and women on Hayling. Considering my grandfather was the commanding officer of HMS Northney 1, 2, 3 and 4, and commanding officer of COP, and had a DSO, and it was known he led the flotilla in to Dieppe.
Because Dieppe, for people that don't know, was a disaster, basically. It was before D-Day. A load of Canadian troops, plus some British, did a raid on the French-occupied French coast, and it was a disaster. Many people were killed.
Hundreds of Canadians were killed, massacred. It was a terrible time for the Canadians, yes. So I would have thought the organiser and author, Robin Walton, would have been only too happy to have included Harold within his book. He's even on a map, which was given to Lord Mountbatten in 1943, where it clearly states, Lieutenant Commander Goulding lives here, Moss Rose Cottage.
So what do you put it down to?
I don't know whether Robin has decided he just doesn't want to include my grandfather, or if there's an ulterior reason.
Maybe sort of professional pride that I'm a historian and I know it all kind of thing. You just don't know. But anyway, tell us a little bit about those that you've met who knew your grandfather, because obviously that's one of the things which has been quite helpful since 2010, when you discovered this attaché case in your loft, to actually have some of the honour that he performed during the war corroborated by people that knew him.
I managed to get hold of John Ainsworth Davis, who telephoned me after I'd spoken to his publisher and told me quite a bit on the phone that he knew my grandfather very well. He described him to me, and the fact that he had actually trained Jad, as we affectionately call him. So I spoke to Jad quite a few times, and then I had the great honour of meeting him at the Newtown House Hotel on Hayling Island. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to talk to him for very long because I was evicted by Robin Walton for showing the cops and copists' families the SBU book, which was signed by the cops and copists.
Hang on, there was a reunion of the cop people, but you were evicted. Explain that, please.
It was actually an open day. It was open to the public.
And you're a member of the public, aren't you?
Correct. Or I thought I was. They had a big display open to the public, and then there was a reception area for the copists and their families. I went in there with Jad, and I was showing some of the other families their father's signatures within the book, and I was just approached and told that if I didn't leave, I would be evicted. Bearing in mind, the last thing I wanted to do was upset these wonderful heroes or their families.
But what was Jad's reaction to that?
Well, I apologised to Jad and said I was very sorry, but I would have to leave. He said he was very embarrassed that Harold was being treated the way he was and that he should be recognised, and that really he thought people just didn't want me talking about Harold. He did tell me that they'd done some very secret things towards the end of the war together.
Your grandfather died quite quickly after the war. What happened there? Because I know his gravestone doesn't even have his surname next to his name or his honour, does it?
That's correct. It doesn't say his surname or his DSO or the fact that he even had a son. It just says, Harry, dearly beloved wife of Edna Goulding, died the 4th of August 1945.
Amazing. And what was Jad's reaction, John Ainsworth Davis' reaction? I'm not sure whether he knew or not that Harold had died so quickly, the guy that had trained him in this commando unit, so quickly after the war.
Jad did ask me about Harold. I told him that he had died in 1945, you know, a few weeks after the war. Jad was rather surprised, but he did say to me that he was rather glad that Harold had died so early, which was a bit of a shock to me, really.
Very strange thing to say.
Very strange. But that they had done secret things together, and Harold, Jad respected so much and said that he was a true gentleman and that he just wouldn't have liked to have been lied to, and Jad felt they had been lied to.
Did he explain how or why?
No, that was it.
What are you doing at the moment in order to try and make sure your grandfather is recognised for his work?
I contacted Lawrence DeMello, an investigative journalist, and Dan Snow. In fact, I sent them both an email on the same day to ask if they would help me get Harold's story out there. Dan Snow, although he was quite involved with the COP event and main speaker, I believe, he didn't answer me at all. Lawrence replied the next day. Lawrence and I got chatting, and with her being a confidant of John Ainsworth Davis, and then with Harold being my grandfather, we clicked immediately. We decided we would write a book together. We've got a lot of top secret, most secret documents. We have the original transcript from the hearing on board Queen Emma the day after Dieppe, which is when Grandpa was being interviewed, basically.
About what happened at Dieppe, because I mean, there's been a whole load of fallout about that over the years, hasn't there?
There has. There's been a lot of books written about Dieppe. I don't believe the truth is yet out there. I'm sure the Germans knew they were coming. Jad informed me that he was there on the hilltop being made to watch after being caught and interrogated. I'm sure that the Germans definitely knew that the Canadians were going into Blue Beach. And unfortunately, Harold had to land them. That was his orders. His signals to the main ship were ignored. He did at least have the opportunity to go in and try and rescue people, but he couldn't get near enough to the shore. There were two boats that went in. They couldn't get near enough to the shore to rescue anyone.
It's a long time ago, isn't it? Maybe it's gone past the time. History's already been written.
Yes, I believe history has been written incorrectly. I would like to see the truth on some of the matters come out. I'd like the people that have written these books about Dieppe to realise that they have some information, not all the information, and they shouldn't write books about things without full knowledge.
But you've been told, basically, by some of the officials involved in the COP organisation, for example, to just get out of the way and forget about it.
Correct, yes, to basically go away, be quiet.
So are you going to do that?
No, I'm absolutely not going to do that. I'm going to have his gravestone rectified. I was lucky enough to meet the Pipers, Mr. Piper Senior and Junior, just a month ago. They were the people that very kindly donated the huge granite stone to the COP memorial. When I told them about Harold's story, they said that they would be more than happy to help me, and they are going to make up a stone inlay for me for Harold's grave, so that the main headstone will not be changed, but there will be an insert to actually honour his name.
Jill, if listeners are interested in following up more about this, how can they reach you and how can they read more about your grandfather?
Probably the best way would be via yourself, Tony, and if you would be good enough to pass on any information, inquiries, help. And if there's a good publisher out there looking for a good book, contact us.
Okay. I'll be more than happy to do that, Jill. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Tony, thank you very much for airing this interview. I much appreciate it, not just for me, but mainly for my grandmother, who had to keep quiet all her life. She died at the age of 99, and she was actually 86 years old before she was even classed as a war widow. Mainly, more than anything else, for my grandfather Harold and his memory.
That was Jill Goulding there talking to me earlier on this week. Martin, this is pretty significant. It certainly corroborates what we've heard about John Ainsworth Davis from him and for Dirty Deals being done at the end of the war, and this suddenly happening to be then covered up.
Yes, I think John Ainsworth Davis wrote a book called Operation JB, Operation James Bond, because James Bond was the name of the operation to extract Martin Bormann from Germany and make sure he had a safe future in Argentina. That's the real meat of this story.
The other thing is, of course, that following on from that, there's this interesting book by Paul Manning, which came out in the early 1980s.
Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile.
Yeah, so there's a kind of underground Fourth Reich, at least, and it seemed to be being aided right from the very beginning by some top people here in the UK. Anyway, we'll see how that transpires. So it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects on Monday at 11 a.m, where we discuss the merchant venturers controlling Bristol schools and find out how the EU, which controls 500 million of us now, really works. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Fabian Breckles, Labour councillor, and also to Ian Fraser. I'm Tony Gosling on Twitter at Tony Gosling, and thisweek.org.uk is this show. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
The Hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, police have stepped up protection for Jewish communities and for police officers following last week's attacks in Paris. The changes will include more patrols near synagogues and Jewish schools. David Cameron's welcomed the announcement.
This is based on what has happened in France, on the whole picture that we see, and it is sensible, precautionary.